I want to get right into the message today. This is number 13 of Here Comes the Judge. God willing, there will be one more installment. And I thought maybe I could get through the entire 11th chapter today, but I see that I might get stuck around verse 40. We'll see. It is a remarkable thing to access the complex answer to a simple question. The simple question that Daniel had in mind, and we must put it in the context. If I were carried away as a captive from my homeland, and now I'm dwelling in the palace of the king, and this is not an unusual circumstance. Most of us think of slavery or servitude as the American brand, the way the history records it, but African slavery, European slavery, it was a different kind of thing. In the Roman days, when the Romans conquered the Greeks, they kept the intelligent people around, made them their servants. They became the teachers of the Roman children, the Greeks, who were smart and brilliant and all those kinds of things. And that pattern was the way it was. So when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem and Judea, he didn't put to death everybody who was had any intelligence and so forth, or who could contribute to the glory of his kingdom. In the case of Daniel and his friends, his three Hebrew friends, they were reared, and they weren't the only ones who were of the princely caste who were kept alive and utilized by Nebuchadnezzar. This was a pattern in ancient times. So what would your concern be, having been taken from your home, placed in a situation where you really are not on your own? You've got to do the things that are required of you, except in the case of Daniel and the Hebrew boys, they also kept a relationship with God going in the midst of all the pagan stuff around them. What would be your question? What would be your concern? To put it in a nutshell, what about how long, O Lord? Now, how long am I going to be stuck here in this situation? Well, Daniel, being a studious individual, having access, after all, remember, Jeremiah had been the one who predicted the downfall of Judah, the house of Judah. So much to the chagrin of the king, who imprisoned Jeremiah, you know, put him down in the mire pit, told him to shut up talking about it, but sure enough, Judah fell. They were carried away into captivity. And you know, Jeremiah wrote down so many things and was kept in a scroll. Well, duh. When Nebuchadnezzar comes in and takes over Judah and the temple, what do you think might have fallen into his hands? The scrolls that Jeremiah wrote. And who would have accessed those scrolls now in the possession of the Babylonian king and ultimately into the hands of the Medo-Persian king? Daniel. And as a result of accessing that information, he had this penetrating question. How long, O Lord? 70 years? Remember, we've already gone over that. That in Jeremiah, the 25th chapter, I believe in verse 10, there is a statement about 70 years being fulfilled about this servitude, or this imprisonment, if you will, of Judah. The house of Judah going into captivity for 70 years. Well, it seems like it's about time for the 70 years to be over. And so Daniel had this question. How long, O Lord? We read about it in Daniel, the 9th chapter, verses 1 through 2. In that 9th chapter is the fascinating prayer that he prays, a prayer of intercession on behalf of Israel, or behalf of Judah. He confesses sins. He confesses that they have forgotten their God. He confesses that perhaps we have learned our lesson, and now your mercy should reign, and you should have mercy upon us to restore us to our former situation. A normal question normal response. Well, as we continue today in chapter 11, Daniel received an answer to his concern from Gabriel in chapter 9 and verse 21. Received an answer. I want to tell you things Daniel was told. I want you to realize some things. In verse 21, yes, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, this is chapter 9 and verse 21, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come for to give you skill and understanding. At the beginning of your supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show you. For you are greatly beloved, therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. So he's given this information. You know, from the time that Daniel sees that image in Daniel 2, all the way through the handwriting on the wall of Daniel 5, and then all into the time of the beasts that he sees in Daniel 7. I have to wonder in my mind how much did he comprehend. After all, so much of it was futuristic. Here he was in the Babylonian Empire. Ultimately, that was overthrown, and then the Medes and the Persian take control. But he's given images and visions of things, such as in chapter 8, about the ram and the goat. Now you got to have some questions about that, because while he's told that the ram is for now, the Medes and the Persian Empire, but the goat is way down the road someplace, and it'll be a great king. Well, it turns out, as we look back in history, we know it was Alexander the Great and the Greek Macedonian Empire. But he didn't know that. That's why the remarkable thing that happens in chapter 8, and the statement that's made there in verse 27, is probably how Daniel felt through much of the things he saw that was so far out in the future, as far as he was concerned. It says, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business. I went about my responsibility. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it." Well, we read in Daniel 9 that that Gabriel says, I want you to understand this. But put yourself in Daniel's shoes. Put yourself in his position. We get nervous when we see some of the futuristic Star Wars kinds of things and other presentations peering into the future as to how things are going to be, and we can't quite comprehend it either. Sometimes it's quite frightening, the possibilities of what could happen down the road in the future. Even though time is moving pretty fast, it seems to us. But if you put yourself in Daniel's circumstance, you would probably have the same kind of question. How long? What's happening? What troubled him most? And this is a good question. What troubled him most? How many of you seen Amistad? The story about the slaves who were taken at sea and brought to the east coast of America. And this happened about 1830, somewhere around in there, when John Quincy Adams had formerly been the president, the son of John Adams. Now he was serving in the Congress of the United States as a representative from Massachusetts, and he wound up being the attorney for these slaves who had been taken, and turns out that they weren't slaves at all, but they had been projected or presented as slaves. And the statement that one of the slaves said was, "We want free." Very powerful moment in the courtroom when he stood up, and the little English he had comprehended from all of the English floating around is, "We want free." What was Daniel's major concern? Freedom. You know, dwelling in the palace of the king of a foreign country did not diminish his desire to return to his home and to be free under his own vine and fig tree. We want free. His major concern was freedom from domination. He knew who he was, and he knew his people, who they were as well. Look at chapter 9 very quickly. Well, I'll just refer to it. This is the prayer he's praying. And he talks about their history. He talks about having been brought out of Egypt by a powerful hand of God, and how God had blessed them, and how they had sinned, and how they had fallen away from him and so forth, and how he was beseeching on their behalf with this intercessory prayer for God's forgiveness. He knew they had to be free not only from their bondage, but had to be free from sin. And so now we enter into the continuing saga of the answer that he receives to the question, how long? How long? I mentioned last time that the course of this book, from the time Daniel receives it to our present day, is about 2,500 years. I think I said 2,600 last time, but, 2,500 to 2,600 years. That's the answer he gets to a 70-year question. That is remarkable. But we are in a good position to understand so much of what he was able to see and what he was told about the coming years. He sees the continuing saga of that Hellenistic period. Hellenistic is a popular term or historical term for a certain group of Greeks and their descendancy from Alexander the Great, his empire that we looked at last time. Remember, it was broken into four different empires when Alexander the Great died. And two of those empires wound up fighting each other back and forth. The king of the north, the Seleucids, and the king of the south, the Ptolemies. Back and forth. The king of the north pushing against the king of the south pushing against the king of the north, and over a period of time, Daniel sees this thing going on. We have come now to verse 28 of the 11th chapter. That's where we stopped last time. And we are right in the midst of a projection of a man who is not named here in the book of Daniel. But historically, we look back, and the biblical scholars have assigned that individual to the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. We talked about him back in some previous chapters of the book of Daniel, in the 9th chapter in particular. He is an amazing individual. His name, as we learned, signifies God manifest. In fact, he printed that on the coins. God manifest. Now, he was only putting himself in a category of God because there were lots of gods in the Greek world. On the other side of one of the coins was Zeus, who certainly was a god in the Greek mythology. So he was not trying to be greater than any other god. He simply put himself in that category, though there are some statements in this chapter we'll see that seem to refer to him, but then perhaps it's for a future type of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I just have to mention this. Antiochus is how we pronounce his name, but the capital of the Seleucid kingdom, the king of the north, was a place called Antioch. Antioch. You've heard of it. Antioch is Antiochus. That's the name. That's the association. That's where the capital was. And so Antiochus and a line of Antiochuses, if I can put it like that, took the name because of the city, and the city took the name because of them. Antiochus or Antioch. So understand that there's that connection there. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes, at this point in verse 28, has emerged on the scene. He's Antiochus the Fourth. And the battles have raged back and forth. And remember, the Bible is written from the perspective of nations and people coming in contact with the people of God. There's nothing extraneous in it. If you look at a prophecy about Edom, for instance, well, it's only in the relationship of what Edom had done to Israel. So when we're reading Daniel 11 in particular, and the battles between the king of the north and the king of the south, it's not extra Judean. It's not outside the realm. It's not just meandering through some possibilities. It's only in relationship to what happens to the people of God. Verse 28. Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. Now, that's an interesting phrase. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. And if you understand, he had been down trying to deal with the Egyptians or the king of the south, and had done some successful things in doing that. And now he's returning to his own land. And verse 29 says, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south. He's going to come back again, trying to get into Egypt and control all that activity there, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, what does that mean? Well, what follows in verse 30 down to verse 32 or so is what is different. What is different is that the people of God, the holy covenant people, the Jews, are going to enter into this picture in a very strange way. It says in verse 30, for the ships of Chittim, I guess is the way you pronounce it. It's really referring to the ships of Tarshish. You know, when you look at the Mediterranean, Tarshish has been projected to be the folk of Spain, the northern part of Africa and the southern part of Europe. Very proficient in shipbuilding. They were descendants, apparently, of the tribe of one of the sons of Noah, Japheth. Very proficient in shipping. Well, it says, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Well, he's going to come back and take it out on the Jews in Jerusalem. Why is he going to do that? Well, war making costs money. It requires some expenditure of expense. Well, you can't believe how rich Jerusalem was with what? Gold in the temple. All of the vessels, all of the accoutrements there. And plus you had the complicity of people in the Jewish government who, to seek favor with Antiochus Epiphanes, entered into what the Bible describes as flatteries. Look at what it says in verse 30. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. Oh, all right. So something was going on in this environment where people were forsaking the holy covenant. Well, who had the holy covenant? The Jewish people. They had it from God, from Mount Sinai. They had an understanding of what he required of them to do. So through bribery and unscrupulous behavior, things happen. History records for us exactly what began to happen. Let me read verse 31. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength. Well, what is the sanctuary? Why would you use that expression? The sanctuary of strength would be the temple. And shall take away the daily sacrifice. Well, what sacrifice goes on? Well, the temple, the Levitical priesthood going through its function. And they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. That is, Antiochus Epiphanes historically put a statue of Jupiter, Zeus. It depends on whether you're talking Roman history or Greek history. They just simply changed the names of the gods, the same gods. But we'll say Zeus, Olympus. Placed him in the entry of the great temple, Solomon's temple. And, well, actually it was not Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple had been destroyed and basically a new temple had been built. So in this circumstance, this intelligence is going back and forth and there's a pollution going on in the temple. And a cessation begins of the abomination or of the sacrifices that were to go on there. Now, how did this all happen? History records these things for us. The high priest, the legitimate high priest at this time was a man named Onias. Well, there was a man named Jason who went to Antiochus Epiphanes and said, hey, I want to be the high priest. And I got a little something, little finance for you. I want to bribe you to get rid of Onias and place me as the high priest. Antiochus Epiphanes had no loyalty or anything about what the covenant says about who was the legitimate high priest. Okay, I can do that. And so Jason takes over. Well, once you go down that road, something else happens. A man named Menelaus, M-E-N-E-L-A-U-S. Menelaus comes along and says, hey, I got some money for you too. I want to bribe you too. And again, Antiochus says, that sounds good to me. I need the money to fight my wars. All right, we'll do that. And he has a brother, Menelaus has a brother named Lysimachus, and they sold, once they got into power as the priest, they sold offerings, they sold the utensils of the temple to finance their bribe to Antiochus Epiphanes. This is what was going on. This is what Daniel sees in answer to his question, how long? Well, it's going to be a long time, Daniel, before what you're looking for happens, because here's the kind of people you're going to be dealing with, or that you're going to have present within the Holy Covenant people. Bribery, flatteries, just silliness. And these are the preachers. These are the priests. These are the people who control the worship of God here in the Holy Land. And verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupted by flatteries, by bribery. That's what was going on. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. In the midst of all of that, Daniel, there will be people who will do the right thing. Surrounded by all of this bribery and flattery and all of this palace intrigue will be the reality that God still matters. What happened during this period of time that Daniel was told about before it happened? Onias was killed. The people rebelled as a result of that and protested to Antiochus Epiphanes and says, we're not going to have it that way. So then Antiochus Epiphanes, in order to keep the peace there, didn't want to fight wars on all kinds of fronts. He sends agents to kill Andronicus, who had been the one who had killed Onias. And Menelaus convinces then Antiochus Epiphanes, I know all these names, you're throwing these names around, what does all that mean? Well, it's from history of showing you what Daniel was able to see. Menelaus then convinces Antiochus Epiphanes to take it out on Jerusalem. The people are rebelling. Get in there and wipe them out. Well, it happened. The representatives who were protesting to Antiochus Epiphanes went up to Tyre. You've heard of Tyre in the Bible. They go up there and he kills them. Antiochus Epiphanes kills them. And because of this bitter disappointment in Antiochus Epiphanes' failed campaign in Egypt and the failed situation there in Jerusalem, he gets ready to settle the score. Remember Jason, who had bribed him and said, I want to be the high priest. Well, okay, you come in and you didn't pay up your bribe, so I've got a bone to settle with you. So now Antiochus comes down to Jerusalem, and do you know 80,000 men, women, and children were killed by Antiochus Epiphanes because of his disappointment, it says, with Jason and that whole intrigue that went on. That many people were killed. It's an amazing time. You've heard of the Maccabees? This is where they fit in history. Judas Maccabees and his brothers, Simon and others, were introduced at this point in history to overthrow this domination of the Greek world, of the Hellenistic world, and the influence of the Seleucids and the battle of the Seleucids, the king of the north, trying to conquer the king of the south and back and forth. And the fighting territory, the place where most of the battles went on, or the place that received the most domination, was Palestine, Jerusalem, in that area. It was in the best interest, the Jews thought, some of them, to get on the good side of the king, whoever it might be, king of the north, king of the south. And recorded for us is the king of the north, who is Antiochus Epiphanes. So that's the essentially the history. In December of the year 168 BC was when the temple was desecrated, when the sacrifice of the sow, the hog on the altar took place, when the implantation of the statue of Zeus was put in, and all of those things, and the abomination that makes desolate took place. Now that was a type of some future thing, but it did happen historically. It did have an impact, and it did cause some concern. Even Jesus Christ referred to the abomination that makes desolate in Matthew 24. He looked back at Daniel's situation of what Daniel saw that actually happened in history in 168 BC and projected it to the end of time when he says, this is one of the things you will see when the end is near. And we look for it now, but hopefully we will not make the mistake that many make. Daniel never made the mistake. He didn't say, well, now I wonder. I think that refers to and puts a name on the person. He doesn't do that. He doesn't do that at all. But when it happens, we will know it has happened because Jesus said it would happen, whoever that may be. You know, the Pope is, packing up, leaving Egypt, and we'll come back down again for another adventure into Jerusalem and all the places that are famous there. You'll go to Bethlehem, you'll go to Nazareth, and you'll go to different places in the month of March. But he just left Sinai, which is part of the Sinai Peninsula where the Ten Commandments were given to Moses. He's making this journey down there. Well, you know, it's hard for me to say that's the false prophet. I mean, it looks like he can't stand up another day with his health and his situation. Maybe the false prophet will come out of that tradition. I don't know. But projecting onto individuals who are on the scene today based on trying to fit these prophecies would be foolhardy at best, in my opinion. So in looking at the events recorded here, they are recorded before the time. One of the problems that the book of Daniel presents to people who study these things is that, well, you can't predict the future. So Daniel must have been written after all this stuff happened. Well, in fact, it was written 500 years before they happened. In some cases, 400 years, 300 years in the case of Antiochus Epiphanes and that whole kind of thing. Daniel was dead and gone by the time some of these things were fulfilled. That's an amazing reality. But in order to diminish the power of God to project into the future and give you the general scenario of things that are going to happen without the specificity of the names that fit, he will tell you a great king will come. He will tell you this nation will do, but you'll have history and from looking at the situation to see how it is all played out and how it's fulfilled. Now, in verse 33, it says, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. I remember this scripture used to be used very much so to tell us, the people of God, that this applies to us today. Well, in principle, it does. But historically, during the time of the Maccabees, it did happen. The Maccabees, you see, were people who wanted to preserve a right relationship with God. They wanted to restore the right high priest to his rightful place and the practices of the sacrifices and all of the things that the covenant required of them. And so they put together an army, a small army. And they kept at bay the power of the kingdom of the Seleucids and Antiochus Epiphanes. These people engaged the Maccabees. They engaged in two things. They engaged in education and evangelism, believe it or not. The very kinds of things that we say we are involved in. They engaged in educating people about their rightful heritage, their right relationship with God, and evangelizing and telling the story among the people so they would not be swayed by the false priests who with flatteries and briberies attached themselves to Antiochus Epiphanes or whatever person was in power at the time. That's an amazing point. It can happen again in type, just as we are here today. What they were telling the people was, get back to God and live according to the scriptures. That's what was going on. That's what that phrase means. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. That's what we're supposed to be about. That's what the people of God today are supposed to be about. And yet, it was like a roller coaster. Vicissitudes, I think, is the word I wrote down. Because it was up, then it was down. Judas was eventually killed. Judas Maccabeus was killed. And his brother took over. And the other relatives, as time progressed along, all the way down to the absence of the Greek Empire and the Romans take over. But they fought, and they fought. And that intertestamental period of time that is captured in what is called the books of the Apocrypha, and especially the books of the Maccabees, we read those sometime for the historical impact, you'll understand what they went through between the time of the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, a period of about 400 years or so. Some say even 600 years. In verse 34, it reads, now, when they shall fall, the Maccabees, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. I mean, isn't that the way it is? I look at the political situation today, and I tell you, you know, at one time there was a favorite son of Texas who looked unbeatable. And everybody was jumping on the bandwagon, you know, patting him on the back. Yeah, you're a shoe-in, you're this and that. And all of a sudden, were all those people who were flattering him. Some people jump ship. Some people say, well, the pasture looks greener on the other side. That's what we're reading in the Bible. Is a picture of the human condition. It happens in any political reality, any political circumstance, any situation where people look out for their best interest. They call it enlightened self-interest. It's a way of life. And the Bible describes it for us. Many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them, in verse 35, of understanding shall fall to try them, that is, to test them, and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. Well, not only is that passage that we just read for an appointed time in the future, in the scenario of the Hellenistic period, the Greek Empire and all of that, but for the time of the end. It's going to happen again. So I would suggest that verse 35 has an application today. And some of them of understanding shall fall. To try them, and to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end. Aren't there scriptures that talk about that? Situations that we could read about in the Bible, about the garments being made white in the snow, being dipped in the blood of the Lamb and cleansed, and being tested and tried, and all of that in the book of Revelation? Well, yes. Plenty of scriptures to that effect. A small number putting many to flight. That's what the Maccabees were about. And then flatteries were put upon them in order to cause some people to stray from the scriptures. But in a historic reality, in verse 35 that we just read, the cause of freedom was maintained through the vicissitudes, the ups and downs of the different successes that they would have. And so it is today. The history of the Maccabees is something that we should be aware of. It's the classic struggle of good versus evil. That's what it's about. There's a spiritual component to the historic struggle during this intertestamental period. A historic a picture, a spiritual component. Good versus evil. Well, I guess you could call it the king of the north versus the king of the south. The Seleucids versus the Ptolemies. God versus Satan. Good versus evil, played out in the history of mankind. And in particular, as Daniel looks at this presentation to him, It is therefore our consideration today because God has played it out historically but has some future things that he wants to share. Verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will. This king right here is called the willful king. Now we move into a time or a situation where the experts don't quite agree. Some say this applies still to Antiochus Epiphanes. Others suggest that it is for a type of Antiochus Epiphanes that shows up at the end of time. We'll see and try to give you some things to consider in this passage. Verses 36 through 39 applies to this willful king. The willful king. Some have exposited it or suggested it means the head of the Roman Empire, or the revived Roman Empire that is referred to in Revelation 19 and verse 20. Let's take a look at that, just to get an idea of some of the thoughts that exist about the things in the book of Daniel. Without the book of Daniel, things in Revelation would not be so clear. Without the book of either book, there we'd be in a mystery about a lot of things of what Jesus said in Matthew 24. So when you're trying to discern Matthew 24, you need Daniel, you need Revelation. They're all combined together. Here is the projection of one called the head of the revived Roman Empire, sometimes called the beast. Chapter 19 and verse 20 says, And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had the mark of the beast. Now, I just use that verse to illustrate to you that there are some who suggest the willful king in Daniel 11, verse 36, is the same beast, the head of that Roman, revived Roman Empire. There are others who suggest that this willful king is the prince that shall come. The prince that shall come. Well, you go back to Daniel now. And the ninth chapter, Daniel 9 and verse 26. That refers to the prince that shall come. Many think that this willful king is a reference to this. This is in verse 26. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end thereof shall be with a flood. And then it talks about unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. So there is a projection that this willful king is this individual. Sometimes people lump them all together. Number three, chapter 11 of Daniel in verse 11 talks about abominations. Chapter 12 and verse 11, it says, And from the time that the daily sacrifices shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. We'll get to that the next time. But the point is that there is a projection to the end of time, so this willful king is thought to be one who manifests himself at the time of the abominations, when that's set up. There's not anything set up yet in Jerusalem. There's not a temple or anything like that that you might project upon. But also in Matthew 24 and verse 15, that's where Jesus refers to the abomination that makes desolate. So the willful king is associated with that abomination that makes desolate. Another association that people have with this willful king is found in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. This is about the man of sin, this willful king. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verses 3 through 8. It says, Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Now, as Paul writes this to the Thessalonians, Antiochus Epiphanes is long since dead. See, so applying the willful king passage in Daniel to this passage is a projection into the future. And that's what Paul was telling the Thessalonians. There is going to be the revelation of this. And what is his characteristics? We'll read it here now before we go back to Daniel. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. The temple of God, proclaiming himself to be his God. Kind of a description that, shakes you up a little bit. I wrote down in my notes, well, what being has an attitude like that? Well, Satan. He's the one who has an attitude. And would he not infuse that attitude upon others? We'll find an interesting point here to be made. And finally, this last exposit about who the willful king might be, Daniel 7. We'll go back to Daniel. I think we might remain here for the remainder of the message. Daniel 7 talks about the little horn, verses 24 through 26. It reads, "And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of times. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end." The willful king. So we go back to the 11th chapter now in verse 36, and we read these verses because we get an idea. My idea is that this individual is either a reference to the Antichrist or primarily Antiochus with an antitypical Antichrist connection. It applies both ways to Antiochus Epiphanes, but there's a breakdown as we shall see. "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god." We read that in Thessalonians. "And shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the gods of his fathers." There's an idea that this willful king is perhaps even a fallen Jew, an individual who has abandoned the Jewish faith. The God of his fathers. Well, that's a thought, that's a possibility that some have embraced, and I understand it. Not making a judgment about it, but I threw it in so you'll know that that's a thought that some people have. "Nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all, including the messianic hope." Some conclude that the passage about the desire of women is a reference to the Messiah coming. And so they conclude that this person exalts himself even above the messianic hope. Verse 38. "But in his estate shall he honor the God of force." Now, the capitalization of the word God here is misleading in the King James. It's referring actually to the gods of fortresses, or the gods of war. Some even think it was a reference to the god of war in the Greek world, Mars. "And a god whom his father knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things." This is a remarkable description of a being out of control, an individual completely out of control. It says in verse 39, "Then shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain." Now, notice that little line that where it says, "Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god." What being on the face of the earth, in doing battle with Jesus Christ in the wilderness, offered Jesus Christ dominion and control and rulership and wealth and riches? It was Satan. Whatever is happening here, all of the battles that have gone on with the people of God in the middle, was by the hand of Satan, ultimately. Satan is the man or the being who controls world-ruling empires and kings and potentates. And that's why Paul wrote what he wrote about the battle of spiritual against spiritual wickedness in high places, against the rulers of the darkness of this world. It's because as we read down through the book of Daniel, especially through this 11th chapter of the intrigue of the battles of the king of the north and the king of the south, what ultimately was going on? Satan attempting to control the world scene, because ultimately what he had hoped for, that he was thwarted in doing before human beings were on the earth, was to take control of the heavens and replace God on the throne. That's what's going on. And as we pause here in our presentation and realize that, realize what's behind palace intrigue, realize why kings rose up against kings, or a prince conspired with another prince, or why Shakespeare could write about Hamlet. And what was that about? Well, Hamlet, the Danish nut, I guess I could call him that. Well, his mother conspired with the brother of her husband to have her husband, the king, killed, and thus the brother becomes king and marries the sister-in-law. When Hamlet comes back home and he hears about all of this, he's upset. He's bothered by it. And so he gets into a battle and ultimately has his stepfather killed. And so goes the stories, and so many of the stories about the kings. Well, Hamlet, Shakespeare wrote about the stuff in England, King Lear, Richard III. We just go down through the history and we see it. So why does it amaze us as we come to American history that there should be palace intrigue or White House intrigue? Why does that surprise us? Why are we disturbed by that? Let alone why there should be kinds of activities like that even in religious circles. Why does that disturb us? Because the ultimate individual influencing all of it is Satan the devil. He's behind the scenes manipulating and controlling, and God permitting it to work out his plan to bring about his reality. So when we come to verse 40, we'll stop here today and pick it up and go all the way now through the end of chapter 12. For it talks, and I'll just read verse 40 to set it into our minds, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him," the king of the north. We've been talking about the king of the north. We've been talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. We've been talking about the Seleucid kingdom in the north and the battles with the king of the south, the Ptolemies. What we read through today leaps over what is called the church age. There's no real reference here about the development of the church, about the apostles and their activities. There's nothing in here about the Middle Ages. There's nothing in the passages we just read. All of it is about this one individual, Antiochus Epiphanes, as an antitype or a type of the evil of the Seleucids versus the evil in the southern kingdom or the king of the south. But it says very clearly in verse 40, "And at the time of the end," this means there is some application for people living in the time of the end. If we are the people who assume we are living at the time of the end, I suggest we might pay close attention to what will follow. "For the king of the south," whoever that is, and people disagree. Some feel that the Arab world is complicit in this battle between the king of the north and king of the south. Some have thought that, you know, the man in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, is the king of the south. You've heard that, haven't you? And so people speculate in that way. I don't think that's true, but then there's some people who say, well, it is south of Jerusalem, so people suggest that. And the king of the north, well, who could that possibly be? You know, well, anciently it was Syria. Antioch is in Syria, and that's where the capital was, but some people like to project it a little further north, across the Mediterranean, you know, somewhere around Rome, or maybe Berlin, or someplace like that. Doesn't say here,
But we do have some warnings and some things to look at, and we will examine those in the next and final installment of a very fascinating study of how God shows a servant of His things that he should be aware of. And I hope those who have ears to hear will hear what the Spirit of the Lord says.